Chapter 3, Eyeless in Gaza. Something strange has been going on in government schools, especially where the matter of reading is concerned. Abundant data exists to show that by 1840, the incidence of complex literacy in the United States was between 93 and 100%, wherever such a thing mattered. Yet compulsory schooling existed nowhere. Between the two world wars, schoolmen seem to have been assigned the task of terminating our universal reading proficiency. The deeds were monstrous, but the doer, Adolf Eichmann, was quite ordinary, commonplace, and neither demonic nor monstrous. There was no sign in him of firm ideological convictions or specific evil motives, and the only notable characteristic one could detect in his past behavior, as well as in his behavior during the trial, was something entirely negative. It was not stupidity, but thoughtlessness. Might not the problem of good and evil, our faculty for telling right from wrong, be connected with our faculty for thought? That quote from Hannah Arendt, The Life of the Mind. And Gatto continues, I always knew school books and real books were different. Most kids do. But I remained vague on any particular grounds for my prejudice until one day, tired of the simple-minded junior high school English curriculum, I decided to teach Moby Dick to eighth grade classes. A friendly assistant principal smuggled a school edition into the book purchases, and we were able to weigh anchor the next fall. What a book! Ishmael, the young seaman who relates Melville's tale, is a half-orphan by decree of fate, sentenced never to know a natural home again. But Ahab is no accidental victim. He has consciously willed his own exile from a young wife and child, from the fruits of his wealth, and from earth itself in order to pursue his vocation of getting even. Revenge on the natural order is what drives him. War against God and family. To me, it defines the essence of Americanness. It's no accident that America's three classic novels, Moby Dick, The Scarlet Letter, and Huckleberry Finn, each deal with ambiguous families, or that each emerges from a time not far from either side of the Civil War. America had been an inferno for families, as Melville, Hawthorne, and Twain all knew. Midway through our first full century as a nation, the nearly universal American experience of homelessness found its voice. Ishmael is a half-orphan. Ahab, an absentee father and husband. The harpooners, expatriate men of color. Pearl, a bastard. Hester, an adulteress. The Reverend Dimmesdale, a sexual predator and runaway father. Huck Finn, de facto an adoptee. Jim, a twice uprooted African slave. When we think what our schools became, we need to recall what a great pile of us are homeless. We long for homes we can never have, as long as we have institutions like school, television, corporation, and government in loco parentis. Patricia Lines of the U.S. Department of Education, in trying honorably to discuss what the rank and file of homeschoolers actually do, finally declared it seems to be wrapped up closely with a feeling of intense interest in the life of the community, close quote. Above anything else, she found loyalty in the warp and woof of family. Homeschoolers are tremendously loyal as family members. They are suspicious of television and other less intimate influences. They eat as a family. They socialize as a family. They attend church as a family. They become members of an extended homeschooling community. American great fiction is about individuals broken from family. The closest they come to satisfying the universal yearning is a struggle for surrogates, like the strange connection between Pearl, Hester, and the Dark Forest. America's most fascinating storytellers focus on the hollowness of American public life. We have no place to go when work is done. Our inner life long extinguished. Our public work in remaking the world can never be done because personal homework isn't available to us. There's no institutional solace for this malady. In outrage at our lonely fate, We lay siege to the family sanctuary wherever it survives, as Ahab lay siege to the seas for his accursed whale. For this and other reasons long lost, I decided to teach Moby Dick to my 8th grade classes, including the dumb ones. I discovered right away that the white whale was just too big for 45-minute bell breaks. I couldn't divide it comfortably to fit the schedule. Melville's book is too vast to say just what the right way to teach it really is. It speaks to every reader privately. To grapple with it demanded elastic time, not the fixed bell breaks of junior high. Indeed, it offered so many choices of purpose, some aesthetic, some historical, some social, some philosophical, some theological, some dramatic, some economic, that compelling the attention of a room full of young people to any one aspect seemed willful and arbitrary. Soon after I began teaching Moby Dick, I realized the school edition wasn't a real book, but a kind of disguised indoctrination, providing all the questions, a scientific addition to the original text designed to make the book teacher-proof and student-proof. If you even read those questions, let alone answer them, there would be no chance ever again for a private exchange between you and Melville. The invisible editor would have preempted it. The editors of the school edition provided a package of prefabricated questions and more than 100 chapter-by-chapter abstracts and interpretations of their own. Many teachers considered this a gift. It does the thinking for them. If I didn't assign these questions, kids wanted to know why not. Their parents wanted to know why not. Unless everyone duly parroted the party line set down by the book editor, children used to getting high marks became scared and angry. The school text of Moby Dick had been subtly denatured. Worse than useless, it was actually dangerous. So I pitched it out and bought a set of undoctored books with my own money. The school edition of Moby Dick asked all the right questions, so I had to throw it away. Real books don't do that. Real books demand people actively participate by asking their own questions. Books that show you the best questions to ask aren't just stupid, they hurt the mind under the guise of helping it, exactly the way standardized tests do. Real books, unlike school books, can't be standardized. They are eccentric. No book fits everyone. If you think about it, schooled people like school books are much alike. Some folks find that desirable for economic reasons. The discipline organizing our economy and our politics derive from mathematical and interpretive exercises, the accuracy of which depends upon customers being much alike and very predictable. People who read too many books get quirky. We can't have too much eccentricity, or it would bankrupt us. Market research depends on people behaving as if they were alike. It doesn't matter whether they are or not. One way to see the difference between school books and real books like Moby Dick is to examine different procedures which separate librarians, the custodians of real books, from school teachers, the custodians of school books. To begin with, libraries are usually comfortable, clean, and quiet. They are orderly places where you can actually read, instead of just pretending to read. For some reason, libraries are never age-segregated, nor do they presume to segregate readers by questionable tests of ability any more than farms or forests or oceans do. The librarian doesn't tell me what to read, doesn't tell me what sequence of reading I have to follow, doesn't grade my reading. The librarian trusts me to have a worthwhile purpose of my own. I appreciate that, and trust the library in return. Some other significant differences between libraries and schools. The librarian lets me ask my own questions and helps me when I want help, not when she decides I need it. If I feel like reading all day long, that's okay with the librarian, who doesn't compel me to stop at intervals by ringing a bell in my ear. The library keeps its nose out of my home. It doesn't send letters to my family, nor does it issue orders on how I should use my reading time at home. The library doesn't play favorites. It's a democratic place, as seems proper in a democracy. If the books I want are available, I get them, even if that decision deprives someone more gifted and talented than I am. The library never humiliates me by posting ranked lists of good readers. It presumes good reading is its own reward and doesn't need to be held up as an object lesson to bad readers. One of the strangest differences between a library and a school is that you almost never see a kid behaving badly in a library. The library never makes predictions about my future based on my past reading habits. It tolerates eccentric reading because it realizes free men and women are often very eccentric. Finally, the library has real books, not school books. I know the Moby Dick I find in the library won't have questions at the end of the chapter or be scientifically Baudelaireized. Library books are not written by collective pens, at least not yet. Real books conform to the private curriculum of each author, not to the invisible curriculum of a corporate bureaucracy. Real books transport us to an inner realm of solitude and unmonitored mental reflection in a way school books and computer programs can't. If they were not devoid of such capacity, they would jeopardize school routines devised to control behavior. Real books conform to the private curriculum of particular authors, not to the demands of bureaucracy. At the start of World War II, millions of men showed up at registration offices to take low-level academic tests before being inducted. The years of maximum mobilization were 1942 to 1944. The fighting force had been mostly schooled in the 1930s, both those inducted and those turned away. Of the 18 million men who were tested, 17,280,000 of them were judged to have the minimum competence in reading required to be a soldier, a 96% literacy rate. Although this was a 2% fall off from the 98% among voluntary military applicants 10 years earlier, the dip was so small it didn't worry anybody. World War II was over in 1945. 6 years later, another war began in Korea. Several million men were tested for military service, but this time 600,000 were rejected. Literacy in the draft pool had dropped to 81%, even though all that was needed to classify a soldier as literate was fourth grade reading proficiency. In the few short years from the beginning of World War II to Korea, a terrifying problem of adult illiteracy had appeared. The Korean War Group received most of its schooling in the 1940s, and it had more years in school with more professionally trained personnel and more scientifically selected textbooks than the World War II men, yet it could not read, write, count, speak, or think, as well as the earlier, less schooled contingent. A third American war began in the mid-1960s. By its end in 1973, the number of men found non-inductible by reason of inability to read safety instructions, interpret road signs, decipher orders, and so on, in other words, the number found illiterate, had reached 27% of the total pool. Vietnam-era young men had been schooled in the 1950s and the 1960s, much better schooled than either of the two earlier groups. But the 4% illiteracy of 1941, which had transmuted into the 19% illiteracy of 1952, had now grown into the 27% illiteracy of 1970. Not only had the fraction of competent readers dropped to 73%, but a substantial chunk of even those were only barely adequate. They could not keep abreast of developments by reading a newspaper. They could not read for pleasure. They could not sustain a thought or an argument. They could not write well enough to manage their own affairs without assistance. Consider how much more compelling the steady progression of intellectual blindness is when we track it through Army admission tests rather than college admission scores and standardized reading tests, which inflate apparent proficiency by frequently changing the way the tests are scored. Looking back, abundant data exists from states like Connecticut and Massachusetts to show that by 1840, the incidence of complex literacy in the United States was between 93 and 100% wherever such a thing mattered. According to the Connecticut Census of 1840, only one citizen out of every 579 was illiterate. And you probably don't want to know, not really, what people in those days considered illiterate. It's too embarrassing. Popular novels of the period give a clue. Last of the Mohicans, published in 1826, sold so well that a contemporary equivalent would have to move 10 million copies to match it. If you pick up an uncut version, you find yourself in a dense thicket of philosophy, history, culture, manners, politics, geography, analysis of human motives and actions, all conveyed in data-rich, periodic sentences so formidable that only a determined and well-educated reader can handle it nowadays. Yet in 1818, we were a small farm nation without colleges or universities to speak of. Could those simple folk have had more complex minds than our own? By 1940, the literacy figure for all states stood at 96% for whites, 80% for blacks. Notice that for all the disadvantages blacks labored under, 4 of 5 were nevertheless literate. 6 decades later, at the end of the 20th century, the National Adult Literacy Survey and the National Assessment of Educational Progress say 40% of blacks and 17% of whites can't read at all. Put another way, black illiteracy doubled, white illiteracy quadrupled. Before you think of anything else in regard to these numbers, think of this. We spend 3 to 4 times as much real money on schooling as we did 60 years ago. But 60 years ago, virtually everyone, black or white, could read. In their famous bestseller, The Bell Curve, prominent social analysts Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein say that what we're seeing are the results of selective breeding in society. Smart people naturally get together with smart people, dumb people with dumb people. As they have children generation after generation, the differences between the groups gets larger and larger. That sounds plausible, and the authors produce impressive mathematics to prove their case. But their documentation shows that they are entirely ignorant of the military data available to challenge their contention. The terrifying drop in literacy between World War II and Korea happened in a decade, and even the brashest survival of the fittest theorist wouldn't argue evolution unfolds that way. The Bell Curve writers say black illiteracy and violence is genetically programmed, but like many academics, they ignore contradictory evidence. For example, on the matter of violence inscribed in black genes, the inconvenient parallel is to South Africa, where 31 million blacks live, the same count as living in the United States. Compare numbers of blacks who died by violence in South Africa in civil war conditions during 1989, 1990, and 1991 with our own peacetime mortality statistics, and you find that far from exceeding the violent death toll in the United States or even matching it, South Africa had proportionately less than 1/4 the violent death rate of American blacks. If more contemporary comparisons are sought, we need only to compare the current black literacy rate in the United States, 56%, with the rate in Jamaica, 98.5%, a figure considerably higher than the American white literacy rate, 83%. If not heredity, what then? Well, one change is indisputable, well documented, and easy to track. During World War II, American public schools massively converted to non-phonetic ways of teaching reading. On the matter of violence alone, this would seem to have impact. According to the Justice Department, 80% of the incarcerated violent criminal population is illiterate or nearly so, and 67% of all criminals locked up. There seems to be a direct connection between the humiliation poor readers experience and the life of angry criminals. As reading ability plummeted in America after World War II, crime soared, so did out-of-wedlock births, which doubled in the 1950s and doubled again in the 1960s, when bizarre violence for the first time became commonplace in daily life. When literacy was first abandoned as a primary goal by schools, white people were in a better position than black people because they inherited a 300-year-old American tradition of learning to read at home by matching spoken sound with letters. Thus, home assistance was able to correct the deficiencies of dumbed-down schools for whites. But black people had been forbidden to learn to read under slavery, and as late as 1930 only averaged 3 to 4 years of schooling. So they were helpless when teachers suddenly stopped teaching children to read, since they had no fallback position. Not helpless because of genetic inferiority, but because they had to trust school authorities to a much greater extent than white people. Back in 1952, the Army quietly began hiring hundreds of psychologists to find out how 600,000 high school graduates had successfully faked illiteracy. Regna Wood sums up the episode this way. After the psychologists told the officers that the graduates weren't faking, Defense Department administrators knew that something terrible had happened in grade school reading instruction, and they knew it had started in the 30s. Why they remained silent, no one knows. The switch back to reading instruction that worked for everyone should have been made then, but it wasn't. In 1882, fifth graders read these authors in their Appleton school reader: William Shakespeare, Henry Thoreau, George Washington, Sir Walter Scott, Mark Twain, Benjamin Franklin, Oliver Wendell Holmes, John Bunyan, Daniel Webster, Samuel Johnson, Lewis Carroll, Thomas Jefferson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and others like them. In 1995, a student teacher of fifth graders in Minneapolis wrote to the local newspaper, quote, "I was told children are not to be expected to spell the following words correctly. Back, big, call, came, can, day, did, dog, down, get, good, have, he, home, if, in, it, is, like, little, man, morning, mother, my, night, off, out, over, people, play, ran, said, saw, she, some, soon, them, their, time, two, up, us, very, water, we, went, where, when, will, would, etc. Is this nuts? Do you think class size, teacher compensation, and school revenue have much to do with education quality? If so, the conclusion is inescapable that we are living in a golden age. From 1955 to 1991, the U.S. pupil-teacher ratio dropped 40%. The average salary of teachers rose 50% in real terms, and the annual expense per pupil, inflation adjusted, soared 350%. What other hypothesis, then, might fit the strange data I'm about to present? Forget the 10% drop in SAT and achievement test scores the press beats to death with regularity. How do you explain the 37% decline since 1972 in students who score above 600 on the SAT? This is an absolute decline, not a relative one. It is not affected by an increase in unsuitable minds taking the test or by an increase in the numbers. The absolute body count of smart students is down drastically, with a test not more difficult than yesterday's, but considerably less so. What should be made of a 50% decline among the most rarefied group of test takers, those who score above 750? In 1972, there were 2,817 American students who reached this pinnacle. Only 1,438 did in 1994, when kids took a much easier test. Can a 50% decline occur in 22 years without signaling that some massive leveling in the public school mind is underway? In a real sense, where your own child is concerned, you might best forget scores on these tests entirely as a reliable measure of what they purport to assess. I wouldn't deny that mass movements in these scores in one direction or another indicate something is going on. And since the correlation between success in schooling and success on these tests is close, then significant score shifts are certainly measuring changes in understanding. This is a difficult matter for anyone to sort out, since many desirable occupational categories and desirable university seats even before that are reserved for those who score well. The resultant linkage of adult income with test scores then creates the illusion that these tests are separating cream from milk. But the results are rigged in advance by foreclosing opportunity to those screened out by the test. In a humble illustration, if you only let students with high scores on the language component of the SATs cut hair, eventually it would appear that verbal facility and grooming of tresses had some vital link with each other. Between 1960 and 1998, the non-teaching bureaucracy of public schools grew 500%, but oversight was concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. The 40,520 school districts with elected boards this nation had in 1960 shriveled to 15,000 by 1998. On the college rung of the school ladder, something queer was occurring too. Between 1960 and 1984, the quality of undergraduate education at America's 50 best-known colleges and universities had altered substantially. According to a 1996 report by the National Association of Scholars, these schools stopped providing, quote, broad and rigorous exposure to major areas of knowledge, quote, for the average student, even at decidedly unaverage universities like Yale and Stanford. In 1964, more than half of these institutions required a thesis or comprehensive for the bachelor's degree. By 1993, 12% did. Over the same period, the average number of classroom days fell 16%, and requirements in math, natural science, philosophy, literature, composition, and history almost vanished. Rhetoric, most potent of the active literacies, completely vanished, and a foreign language, once required at 96% of the great colleges, fell to 64%. According to the Journal of the American Medical Association of December 1995, 33% of all patients cannot read and understand instructions on how often to take medication, notices about doctor's appointments, consent forms, labels on prescription bottles, insurance forms, and other simple parts of self-care. They are rendered helpless by the inability to read. Concerning those behind the nation's prison walls, a population that has tripled since 1980, the National Center for Education Statistics stated in a 1996 report that 80% of all prisoners could not interpret a bus schedule, understand a news article or warranty instructions, or read maps, schedules, or payroll forms, nor could they balance a checkbook. 40% could not calculate the cost of a purchase. Once upon a time, we were a new nation that allowed ordinary citizens to learn how to read well and encouraged them to read anything they thought would be useful. Close reading of tough-minded writing is still the best, cheapest, and quickest method known for learning to think for yourself. This invitation to commoners extended by America was the most revolutionary pedagogy of all. Reading and rigorous discussion of that reading in a way that obliges you to formulate a position and support it against objections is an operational definition of education in its most fundamental civilized sense. No one can do this very well without learning ways of paying attention, from a knowledge of diction and syntax, figures of speech, etymology, and so on, to a sharp ability to separate the primary from the subordinate, understand allusion, master a range of modes of presentation, test truth, and penetrate beyond the obvious to the profound messages of text. Reading, analysis, and discussion are the way we develop reliable judgment, the principal way we come to penetrate covert movements behind the facade of public appearances. Without the ability to read and argue, we're just geese to be plucked. Just as experience is necessary to understand abstraction, so the reverse is true. Experience can only be mastered by extracting general principles out of the mass of details. In the absence of a perfect universal mentor, books and other texts are the best and cheapest stand-ins, always available to those who know where to look. Watching details of an assembly line or a local election unfold isn't very educational, unless you have been led in careful ways to analyze the experience. Reading is the skeleton key for all who lack a personal tutor of quality. Reading touches nothing more important than the state of mind in which you find yourself absolutely alone with the thoughts of another mind, a matchless form of intimate rapport available only to those with the ability to block out distraction and concentrate. Hence the urgency of reading well, if you read for power. Once you trust yourself to go mind to mind with great intellects, artists, scientists, warriors, and philosophers, you are finally free. In America, before we had forced schooling, an astonishing range of unlikely people knew reading was like Samson's locks, something that could help make them formidable, that could teach them their rights and how to defend those rights, could lead them toward self-determination, free from intimidation by experts. These same unlikely people knew that the power bestowed through reading could give them insight into the ways of the human heart, so they would not be cheated or fooled so easily, and that it could provide an inexhaustible store of useful knowledge, advice on how to do just about anything. By 1812, Pierre Dupont was claiming that barely 4 in 1,000 Americans were unable to read well, and that the young had skill in argumentation thanks to daily debates at the common breakfast table. By 1820, there was even more evidence of Americans' avid reading habits, when 5 million copies of James Fenimore Cooper's complex and elusive novels were sold, along with an equal number of Noah Webster's didactic Speller, to a population of dirt farmers under 20 million in size. In 1835, Richard Cobden announced that there was 6 times as much newspaper reading in the United States as in England, and the census figures of 1840 gave fairly exact evidence that a sensational reading revolution had taken place without any exhortation on the part of public moralists and social workers, but because the common people had the initiative and freedom to learn. In North Carolina, the worst situation of any state surveyed, 8 out of 9 could still read and write. In 1853, Per Siljeström, a Swedish visitor, wrote, "In no country in the world is the taste for reading so diffuse as among the common people in America." The American Almanac observed grandly, quote, "Periodical publications, especially newspapers, disseminate knowledge throughout all classes of society and exert an amazing influence in forming and giving effect to public opinion," close quote. It noted the existence of over 1,000 newspapers. In this nation of common readers, The spiritual longings of ordinary people shaped the public discourse. Ordinary people who could read, though not privileged by wealth, power, or position, could see through the fraud of social class or the even grander fraud of official expertise. That was the trouble. In his book, The New Illiterates, author Sam Blumenfeld gives us the best introduction to what went wrong with reading in the United States. He also gives us insight as to why learning to read needn't be frustrating or futile. A typical letter from one of his readers boasts of her success in imparting the alphabet code to 4 children under the age of 5 by the simple method of practice with letter sounds. One day she found her 3-year-old working his way through a lesson alone at the kitchen table reading S-Am-Sam-M-A-N, man, and so on. Her verdict on the process: I had just taught him his letter sounds. He picked the rest up and did it himself. That's how simple it is. I know a school for kids ages 3 to 18 that doesn't teach anybody to read, yet everyone who goes there learns to do it, most very well. It's the beautiful Sudbury Valley School, 20 miles west of Boston, in the old Nathaniel Bowditch cottage, which looks suspiciously like a mansion. A place ringed by handsome outbuildings, a private lake, woods, and acres of magnificent grounds. Sudbury is a private school, but with a tuition under $4,000 a year, it's considerably cheaper than a seat in a New York City public school. At Sudbury, kids teach themselves to read. They learn at many different ages, even into the teen years, though that's rare. When each kid is ready, he or she self-instructs, if such a formal label isn't inappropriate for such a natural undertaking. During this time, they are free to request as much adult assistance as needed. That usually isn't much. In 30 years of operation, Sudbury has never had a single kid who didn't learn to read. All this is aided by a magnificent school library on open shelves where books are borrowed and returned on the honor system. About 65% of Sudbury kids go on to good colleges. The place has never seen a case of dyslexia. That's not to say some kids don't reverse letters and such from time to time, but such conditions are temporary and self-correcting, unless institutionalized into a disease. So Sudbury doesn't even teach reading, yet all its kids learn to read and even like reading. What could be going on there that we don't understand? The miracle woman who taught me to read was my mother, Booty. Booty never got a college degree. But nobody despaired about that, because daily life went right along then without too many college graduates. Here was Booty's scientific method. She would hold me on her lap and read to me while she ran her finger under the words. That was it, except to read always with a lively expression in her voice and eyes, to answer my questions, and from time to time to give me some practice with different letter sounds. One thing more is important. For a long time, we would sing A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, and so on, every single day. We learned to love each letter. She would read tough stories as well as easy ones. Truth is, I don't think she could readily tell the difference any more than I could. The books had some pictures, but only a few. Words made up the center of attention. Pictures have nothing at all to do with learning to love reading, except too many of them will pretty much guarantee that it never happens. Over 50 years ago, my mother, Booty Zimmer, chose to teach me to read well. She had no degrees, no government salary, no outside encouragement, yet her private choice to make me a reader was my passport to a good and adventurous life. Booty, the daughter of a Bavarian printer, said nuts to the Prussian system. She voted for her own right to decide, and for that I will always be in her debt. She gave me a love of language, and it didn't cost much. Anybody could have the same if schooling hadn't abandoned its duty so flagrantly. The religious purpose of modern schooling was announced clearly by the legendary University of Wisconsin sociologist Edward A. Ross in 1901 in his famous book, Social Control. Your librarian should be able to locate a copy for you without much trouble. In it, Ed Ross wrote these words for his prominent following, quote, "Plans are underway to replace community, family, and church with propaganda, education, and mass media. The state shakes loose from the church, reaches out to school. People are only little plastic lumps of human dough," close quote. Social control revolutionized the discipline of sociology and had powerful effects on the other human sciences. In social science, it guided the direction of political science, economics, and psychology. In biology, it influenced genetics, eugenics, and psychobiology. It played a critical role in the conception and design of molecular biology. There you have it, in a nutshell, the whole problem with modern schooling. It rests on a nest of false premises. People are not little plastic lumps of dough. They are not blank tablets, as John Locke said they were. They are not machines, as Delametri hoped. Not vegetables, as Friedrich Froebel, inventor of kindergartens, hypothesized. Not organic mechanisms, as Wilhelm Wundt taught every psychology department in America at the turn of the century. Nor are they repertoires of behaviors, as Watson and Skinner wanted. They are not, as the new crop of systems thinkers would have it, mystically harmonious microsystems interlocking with grand macrosystems in a dance of atomic forces. I don't want to be crazy about this. Locked in a lecture hall or bull session, there's probably no more harm in these theories than reading too many Italian sonnets all at one sitting. But when each of these suppositions is sprung free to serve as a foundation for school experiments, it leads to frightfully oppressive practices. One of the ideas that empty child thinking led directly to was the notion that human breeding could be enhanced or retarded, as plant and animal breeding was, by scientific gardeners and husbandmen. Of course, the time scale over which this was plotted to happen was quite long. Nobody expected it to be like breeding fruit flies, but it was a major academic, governmental, and even military item, generously funded until Hitler's proactive program following America's lead grew so embarrassing by 1939 that our own projects and plans were made more circumspect. Back at the beginning of the 20th century, the monstrously influential Edward Thorndike of Columbia Teachers College said that school would establish conditions for, quote, selective breeding before the masses take things into their own hands, close quote. The religious purpose of modern schooling was embarrassingly evident back when Ross and Thorndike were on center stage. But they were surrounded by many like-minded friends. Another major architect of standardized testing, H.H. Goddard, said in his book Human Efficiency, 1920, that government schooling was about the perfect organization of the hive, close quote. He said standardized testing was a way to make lower classes recognize their own inferiority. Like wearing a dunce cap, it would discourage them from breeding and having ambition. Goddard was head of the psychology department at Princeton. So imagine the effect he had on the minds of doctoral candidates he coached, and there were hundreds. We didn't leave the religious purpose of modern schooling back in the early years of the century. In April of 1996, Al Shanker of the American Federation of Teachers said in his regular New York Times split-page advertisement that every teacher was really a priest. Something strange is going on in schools and has been going on for quite some time. Whatever it is does not arise from the main American traditions. As closely as I can track the thing through the attitudes, practices, and stated goals of the shadowy crew who make a good living skulking around educational laboratories, think tanks, and foundations, we are experiencing an attempt, successful so far, to reimpose the strong state, strong social class attitudes of England and Germany on the United States, the very attitudes we threw off in the American Revolution. And in this counter-revolution, the state churches of England and Germany have been replaced by the secular church of forced government schooling. Advertising, public relations, and the stronger forms of quasi-religious propaganda are so pervasive in our schools, even in, quote, alternative schools, that independent judgment is suffocated in mass-produced secondary experiences and market-tested initiatives. Lifetime Learning Systems, one of the many new corporations formed to dig gold from our conditions of schooling, announced to its corporate clients, quote, "School is the ideal time to influence attitudes, build long-term loyalties, introduce new products, test market, promote sampling and trial usage, and above all, to generate immediate sales," close quote. Arnold Toynbee, the establishment's favorite historian in mid-20th century America, said in his monumental study of history that the original promise of universal education has been destroyed as soon as the school laws were passed, a destruction caused by, quote, "the possibility of turning education to account as a means of amusement for the masses," close quote, and a means of, quote, "profit for the enterprising persons by whom the amusement is purveyed," close quote. This opportunistic conversion quickly followed mass schooling's introduction when fantastic profit potential set powerful forces in motion. The bread of universal education is no sooner cast upon the water than a shoal of sharks arises from the depths and devours the children's bread under the educators' very eyes. In Toynbee's analysis, the dates speak for themselves. The edifice of universal education was, roughly speaking, completed in 1870, and the yellow press was invented 20 years later. As soon, that is, as the first generation of children from the national schools had acquired sufficient purchasing power, by a stroke of irresponsible genius, which had divined that the educational labor of love could be made to yield a royal profit. But vultures attending the inception of forced compulsion schooling attracted more ferocious predators. The commercial institutions that set about at once to prey on forced mass schooling attracted the attention of the rulers of modern national states. If press lords could make millions by providing idle amusement for the half-educated, serious statesmen could draw, not money perhaps, but power from the same source. The modern dictators have deposed the press lords and substituted for crude and debased private entertainment an equally crude and debased system of state propaganda. Looking back on the original period of school formation in her study of American history textbooks, America Revised, Frances Fitzgerald remarked on the profound changes that emerged following suggestions issued by sociologists and social thinkers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. "The original history of our institutions and the documents which protect our unique liberties gradually began to be effaced." Fitzgerald raises the puzzle of textbook alteration. Quote, "The ideology that lies behind these texts is rather difficult to define. It does not fit usual political patterns. The texts never indicate any line of action. Authors avoid what they choose to, and some of them avoid main issues. They fail to develop any original ideas. They confuse social sciences with science, clouds of jargon, leave out ideas. Historical names are given no character. They are cipher people. There are no conflicts, only problems." Close quote. Indeed, the texts may be unfathomable, and that may be the editorial intent. In 1982, Anthony Ettinger, a member of the private discussion group called the Council on Foreign Relations, asked an audience of communication executives this question: "Do we really have to have everybody literate? writing and reading in the traditional sense, when we have the means through our technology to achieve a new flowering of oral communication? Ettinger suggested our idea of literacy is obsolete. 83 years earlier, John Dewey had written in The Primary Education Fetish that the plea for the predominance of learning to read in early school life because of the great importance attaching to literature seems to be a perversion. Close quote. For the balance of this discussion, I'm going to step into deeper water, first reviewing what reading in a Western alphabet really means, and what makes it a reasonably easy skill to transmit or to self-teach, and then tackling what happened to deprive the ordinary person of the ability to manage it very well. I want to first show you how, then answer the more speculative question, why. The National Adult Literacy Survey represents 190 million U.S. adults over age 16 with average school attendance of 12.4 years. The survey is conducted by the Educational Testing Service of Princeton, New Jersey. It ranks adult Americans into five levels. Here is its 1993 analysis. 42 million Americans over the age of 16 can't read. Some of this group can write their names on Social Security cards and fill in height, weight, and birth spaces on application forms. 50 million can recognize printed words on a fourth and fifth grade level. They cannot write simple messages or letters. 55 to 60 million are limited to sixth, seventh, and eighth grade reading. A majority of this group could not figure out the price per ounce of peanut butter in a 20-ounce jar costing $1.99 when they could round the answer off to a whole number. 30 million have 9th and 10th grade reading proficiency. This group, and all preceding, cannot understand a simplified written explanation of the procedures used by attorneys and judges in selecting juries. About 3.5% of the 26,000-member sample demonstrated literacy skills adequate to do traditional college study, a level 30% of all U.S. high school students reached in 1940, and which 30% of secondary students in other developed countries can reach today. This last fact alone should warn you how misleading comparisons drawn from international student competitions really are, since the samples each country sends are small elite ones, unrepresentative of the entire student population. But behind the bogus superiority, a real one is concealed. 96.5% of the American population is mediocre to illiterate where deciphering print is concerned. This is no commentary on their intelligence, but without ability to take in primary information from print and to interpret it, they are at the mercy of commentators who tell them what things mean. A working definition of immaturity might include an excessive need for other people to interpret information for us. Certainly it's possible to argue that bad readers aren't victims at all, but perpetrators, cursed by their inferior biology to possess only shadows of intellect. That's what bell curve theory, evolutionary theory, aristocratic social theory, eugenics theory, strong state political theory, and some other kinds of theology are about. All agree most of us are inferior, if not downright dangerous. The integrity of such theoretical outlooks, at least where reading was concerned, took a stiff shot on the chin from America. Here, democratic practice allowed a revolutionary generation to learn how to read. Those granted the opportunity took advantage of it brilliantly. So how was the murder of American reading ability pulled off? I'll tell you in a second. But come back first to classical Greece, where the stupendous invention of the alphabet by Phoenicians was initially understood. The Phoenicians had an alphabetic language they used to keep accounts, but the Greeks were the first to guess correctly that revolutionary power could be unleashed by transcending mere lists, using written language for the permanent storage of analysis, exhortation, visions, and other things. After a period of experiment, the Greeks came up with a series of letters to represent sounds of their language. Like the Phoenicians, they recognized the value of naming each letter in a way distinct from its sound value, as every human being has a name distinct from his or her personality, as numbers have names for reference. Naming sounds rather than things was the breakthrough. While the number of things to be pictured is impossibly large, the number of sounds is strictly limited. In English, for example, most people only recognize 44. The problem, which American families once largely solved for themselves, is this. In English, a Latin alphabet has been imposed on a Germanic language with multiple non-Germanic borrowings, and it doesn't quite fit. Our 44 sounds are spelled 400-plus different ways. That sounds horrible. But in reality, in the hands of even a mediocre teacher, it's only annoying. In the hands of a good one, a thrilling challenge. Actually, 85% of the vast word stock of English can be read with knowledge of only 70 of the phonograms. A large number of the remaining irregularities seldom occur and can be remastered on an as-needed basis. Meanwhile, a whole armory of mnemonic tricks like "If a C I chance to spy, place the E before the I," exists to get new readers over the common humps. Inexpensive dictionaries, spell-check typewriters, computers, and other technology are readily available these days to silently coach the fearful. But in my experience, that fear is neither warranted nor natural. Instead, it is engendered. Call it good business practice. Also, communicating abstractions in picture language is a subtlety requiring more time and training to master than is available for most of us. Greeks could organize ambitious concepts abstractly in written language, communicating accurately with each other over space and time much more readily than their competitors. According to Mitford Matthews, the secret of their phenomenal advance was in their conception of the nature of a word. They reasoned that words were sounds or combinations of ascertainable sounds, and they held inexorably to the basic proposition that writing, properly executed, was a guide to sound reading. A number of other good treatments are available for the newcomer. Close quote. Learning sound-sight correspondence first comes in alphabetic language. Competence with the entire package of sounds corresponding to alphabet symbols comes quickly. After that, anything can be read, and its meaning inquired after. The substantial speaking vocabulary kids bring to school, 6,000 to 10,000 words, can now be read at once and understood. When the Romans got the alphabet through the Etruscans, they lost the old letter names, so they invented new ones, making them closer to the letter sounds. This was a significant mistake which causes confusion in novice readers even today. Through conquest, the Latin alphabet spread to the languages of Europe. Rome's later mutation into the universal Christian Church caused Latin, the language of church liturgy, to flow into every nook and cranny of the former empire. The Latin alphabet was applied to the English language by Christian missionaries in the 7th century. While it fused with spoken English, this was far from a perfect fit. There were no single letters to stand for certain sounds. Scribes had to scramble to combine letters to approximate sounds that had no companion letter. This matching process was complicated over centuries by repeated borrowings from other languages and by certain massive sound shifts which still occupy scholars in trying to explain. Before the spread of printing in the 16th century, not being able to read wasn't much of a big deal. There wasn't much to read. The principal volume available was the Bible, from which appropriate bits were read aloud by religious authorities during worship and on ceremonial occasions. Available texts were in Latin or Greek, but persistent attempts to provide translations was a practice thought to contain much potential for schism. An official English Bible, the Authorized King James Version, appeared in 1611, preempting all competitors in a bold stroke which changed popular destiny. Instantly, the Bible became a universal textbook, offering insights both delicate and powerful. A vibrant cast of characters, brilliant verbal pyrotechnics and more to the humblest rascal who could read. Talk about a revolutionary awakening for ordinary people. The Bible was it, thanks to the dazzling range of models it provided in the areas of exegesis, drama, politics, psychology, characterization, plus the formidable reading skills it took to grapple with the Bible. A little more than three decades after this translation, the English king was deposed and beheaded. The connection was direct. Nothing would ever be the same again, because too many good readers had acquired the proclivity of thinking for themselves. The magnificent enlargement of imagination and voice that the Bible's exceptional catalog of language and ideas made available awakened in ordinary people a powerful desire to read in order to read the holy book without a priest's mediation. Strenuous efforts were made to discourage this, but the Puritan Revolution and Cromwell's interregnum sent literacy surging. Nowhere was it so accelerated as in the British colonies of North America, a place already far removed from the royal voice. Printing technology emerged. Like the computer in our own day, it was quickly incorporated into every corner of daily life. But there were still frequent jailings, whippings, and confiscations for seditious reading as people of substance came to realize how dangerous literacy could be. Reading offered many delights, cravings to satisfy curiosity about this Shakespeare fellow, or to dabble in the musings of Lord Bacon or John Locke were now not difficult to satisfy. Spelling and layout were made consistent. Before long, prices of books dropped. All this activity intensified pressure on illiterate individuals to become literate. The net result of printing and Protestantism, which urged communicants to go directly to the word, eliminating the priestly middleman, stimulated the spread of roving teachers and small proprietary and church schools. A profession arose to satisfy demand for a popular way to understand what uses to make of books, and from this a demand to understand many things. The first schoolman to seriously challenge what is known today as phonics was Friedrich Gedecky, a disciple of Rousseau, director of a well-known gymnasium in Prussia. In 1791, he published the world's first Look-Say Primer, a children's reader without the ABCs and spelling. The idea was to eliminate drill. Kids would learn through pictures, following suggestions the legendary mystic and scholar Comenius set down in his famous Orbis Pictus of 1657. After a brief splash and three editions, the fashion vanished for an excellent reason. As good as it sounds in theory, it doesn't work well at all in practice. Though here and there exceptions are encountered, and infuriatingly enough, it can seem to work in the early years of first and second grade. Soon after that, the rapidly developing reading power in phonetically trained children makes them capable of recognizing in print their entire speaking and listening vocabulary, while look-say-trained readers can read without error only the words they have memorized as whole shapes, a relative handful. This is devilishly complex terrain. Gedecky's theory held that when enough words are ingested and recognized, the student can figure out for himself the 70 key phonograms of the English language. Indeed, this is the only credible explanation which could account for the well-known phenomenon of children who teach themselves to read handily without the use of any system at all. I have no doubt children occasionally learn to read this way. Yet, if true, how do we account for the grotesque record of whole word instruction over a century and a half in every conceivable school setting? Money, time, attention, and caring adults in profusion, all have been available to make this alternative method work to teach reading proficiency. Yet its record in competition with the old-fashioned alphabet system is horrifying. What might account for this? I have a hunch based on a decade of ruminating. Since no one has yet bothered to assemble a large group of self-taught good readers to ask them how it happened, let my hunch serve as a working hypothesis for you to chew upon at your leisure. Consider the matter of time. The average 5-year-old can master all of the 70 phonograms in 6 weeks. At that point, he can read just about anything fluently. Can he understand everything? No, of course not. But also, no synthetic barrier to understanding is being interposed by weird-looking words to be memorized whole, either. Paulo Freire taught ignorant campesinos with no tradition of illiteracy at all to read in 30 hours. They were adults with different motivations than children, but when he showed them a sentence and they realized it said, "The land belongs to the tiller," they were hooked. That's Jesuit savvy for you. Back to this matter of time. By the end of the 4th grade, phonics-trained students are at ease with an estimated 24,000 words. Whole word-trained students have memorized about 1,600 words and can successfully guess at some thousands more, but also unsuccessfully guess at thousands too. One reigning whole word expert has called reading a psycholinguistic guessing game, in which the reader is not extracting the writer's meaning, but constructing a meaning of his own. While there is an attractive side to this that is ignored by critics of whole language, and I number myself among these, the value doesn't begin to atone for the theft of priceless reading time and guided practice. As long as whole language kids are retained in a hothouse environment, shielded from linguistic competition, things seem idyllic. But once mixed together with phonetically trained kids of similar age and asked to avail themselves of the intellectual treasure locked up in words, the result is not so pretty. Either the deficient kid must retreat from the field with a whopping sense of inferiority, or worse, he must advance aggressively into the fray, claiming books are overrated, that thinking and judgment are merely matters of opinion. The awful truth is that circumstances hardly give us the luxury of testing Gedecky's hypothesis about kids being able to deduce the rules of language from a handful of words. Humiliation makes mincemeat of most of them long before the trial is fairly joined. So the second hunch I have is that where whole word might work when it works at all, is in a comfortable, protected environment without people around to laugh derisively at the many wretched mistakes you must make on the way to becoming a Columbus of language. But in case you hadn't noticed, schools aren't safe places for the young to guess at meanings of things. Only an imbecile would pretend that school isn't a pressure cooker of psychodrama. Wherever children are gathered into groups by compulsion, a pecking order soon emerges in which malice, mockery, intimidation of the weak, envy, and a whole range of other nasty characteristics hold sway, like the famous mill pond of Huxley's, whose quiet surface mirroring fall foliage conceals a murderous subterranean world whose law is eat or be eaten. That's melodramatic, I suppose. Yet 30 classroom years, and a decade more as a visitor in hundreds of other schools, have shown me what a meat grinder the peaceful classroom really is. Bill is wondering whether he will be beaten again on the way to the lunchroom. Molly is paralyzed with fear that the popular Jean will make loud fun of her prominent teeth. Ronald is digging the point of a sharpened pencil into the neck of Herbert, who sits in front of him, all the while whispering he will get Herb good if he gets Ron in trouble with the teacher. Alan is snapping a rubber band at Flo. Ralph is about to call Leonard trailer park trash for the 300th time that day, Not completely clear he knows what it means, yet enjoying the anguish it brings to Leonard's face. Greta, the most beautiful girl in the room, is practicing ogling Shire boys, then cutting them dead when she evokes any hopeful smiles in response. Willie is slowly shaken down for a dollar by Phil. And Mary's single mom has just received an eviction notice. Welcome to another day in an orderly scientific classroom. Teacher may have a permanent simper pasted on her face, but it's deadly serious the world she presides over, a bad place to play psycholinguistic guessing games, which involves sticking one's neck out in front of classmates as the rules of language are empirically derived. A method that finds mistakes to be charming stabs in the right direction, maybe on to something person to person or in the environment of a loving home, but it's dynamically unsuited to the forge of forced schooling. After Gedecky, the next innovator to hit on a reading scheme was Jean-Joseph Jacotot, a grand genius much misunderstood. A professor of literature at 19, Jacotot discovered a method of teaching non-speakers of French the French language, beginning not with primers, but with Fenelon's Telemachus. Jacotot read aloud slowly while students followed his reading in a dual translation, to their own familiar language and to Fenelon spoken French. Then the process was repeated. After the group reading, each student individually dismantled the entire book into parts, into smaller parts, into paragraphs, into sentences, into words, and finally into letters and sounds. This followed the natural pattern of scientists, it was thought, beginning with holes and reducing them to smaller and smaller elements. Jacotot has a reputation as a whole-word guru, but any resemblance to contemporary whole-word reading in Jacotot is illusion. His method shifts the burden for analysis largely from the shoulders of the teacher to the student. The trappings of holistic non-competitiveness are noticeably absent. Penalty for failure in his class was denial of advancement. Everyone succeeded in Jacotot's system, but then his students were highly motivated, self-selected volunteers, all of college age. From Jacotot, we got the idea anybody can teach anything. His was the concept of the ignorant schoolmaster. It should surprise no one that the ideas of Jacotot interested Prussians who brought this system back to Germany and modified it for younger children. For them, however, a book seemed too impractical a starting point. Perhaps a sentence would be better, or a single word. Eventually, it was the latter settled upon. Was this the genesis of whole-word teaching, which eventually dealt American reading ability a body blow? The answer is a qualified no. In the German normal word method, the whole word was not something to be memorized, but a specimen of language to be analyzed into syllables. The single word was made a self-conscious vehicle for learning letters. Once letter sounds were known, reading instruction proceeded traditionally. To a great extent, this is the method my German mother used with my sister and me to teach us to read fluently before we ever saw first grade. Two flies now enter the reading ointment in the persons of Horace Mann and his second wife, Mary Peabody. There is raw material here for a great intrigue novel. In the early 1830s, a minister in Hartford, Thomas Gallaudet, invented a sight-reading, look-say method to use with the deaf. Like Jacotot, Gallaudet was a man of unusual personal force and originality. He served as director at the Asylum for the Education of the Deaf and Dumb in Hartford. Deaf-mutes couldn't learn a sound symbol system, it was thought. So Gallaudet devised a sight-reading vocabulary of 50 whole words, which he taught through pictures. Then his deaf students learned a manual alphabet, which permitted them to indicate letters with their fingers and communicate with others. Even in light of the harm he inadvertently caused, it's hard not to be impressed by Gallaudet. In Gallaudet's system, writing transmuted from a symbolic record of sounds to a symbolic record of pictures. Gallaudet had reinvented English as ancient Babylonian. One of his former teachers, William Woodbridge, then editor of the American Annals of Education, received a long detailed letter in which Gallaudet described his flashcard method and demanded that education be regarded as a science like chemistry. Mind like matter can be made subject to experiment. 50 words could be learned by memory before introducing the alphabet. By removing the dull and tedious normal method, great interest has been excited in the mind of the little learner. Close quote. Historically, three important threads run together here. 1. That learning should be scientific and learning places a laboratory. 2. That words be learned ideographically. 3. That relieving boredom and tedium should be an important goal of pedagogy. Each premise was soon pushed to extremes. These themes institutionalized would ultimately require a vast bureaucracy to enforce, but all this lay in the future. Gallaudet had adopted the point of view of a deaf-mute who had to make his way without assistance from sound to spoken language. Samuel Blumenfield's analysis of what was wrong with this is instructive. Quote, "It led to serious confusions in Gallaudet's thinking concerning two very different processes, that of learning to speak one's native language and that of learning to read it. In teaching the deaf to read by sight, he was also teaching them language by sight for the first time. They underwent two learning processes, not one. But a normal child came to school already with the knowledge of several thousand words in his speaking vocabulary, with a much greater intellectual development which the sense of sound afforded him. In learning to read, it was not necessary to teach him what he already knew, to repeat the process of learning to speak. The normal child did not learn his language by learning to read. He learned to read in order to help him expand his use of the language." Close quote. In 1830, Gallaudet published The Child's Picture Defining and Reading Book, a book for children with normal hearing, seeking to generalize his method to all. In its preface, the book sets down for the first time basic whole word protocols. Words will be taught as representing objects and ideas, not as sounds represented by letters. He who controls language controls the public mind, a concept well understood by Plato. Indeed, the manipulation of language was at the center of curriculum at the Collegia of Rome, in the Jesuit academies and the private schools maintained for children of the influential classes. It made up an important part of the text of Machiavelli. It gave rise to the modern arts and sciences of advertising and public relations. The whole word method, honorably derived and employed by men like Gallaudet, was at the same time a tool to be used by any regime or interest with a stake in limiting the growth of intellect. Gallaudet's primer, Lost to History, was published in 1836. 1 year later, the Boston School Committee was inaugurated under the direction of Horace Mann. Although no copies of the primer have survived, Blumenfield tells us, "From another source we know that its first line was, 'Frank had a dog, his name was Spot.'" On August 2, 1836, Gallaudet's primer was adopted by the Boston Primary School Committee on an experimental basis. A year later, a report was issued pronouncing the method a success on the basis of speed in learning when compared to the alphabet system, and of bringing a pleasant tone to the classroom by removing the old, unintelligible, and irksome mode of teaching certain arbitrary marks or letters by certain arbitrary sounds. Close quote. A sight vocabulary is faster to learn than letters and phonograms, but the gain is a Trojan horse. Only after several years have passed does the sight reader's difficulty learning words from outside sources begin to become apparent. By that time, conditions made pressing by the social situation of the classroom and demands from the world at large combined to make it hard to retrace the lost ground. Mann endorsed Gallaudet's primer in his second annual report of 1838. His endorsement, Gallaudet's general fame and public adulation, Erroneous reports circulating at the time that Mighty Prussia was using a whole word system, and possibly the prospect of fame and a little profit, caused Mann's own wife, Mary Tyler Peabody, whose family names were linked to a network of powerful families up and down the eastern seaboard, to write a whole word primer. The Mann family was only one of a host of influential voices being raised against the traditional reading instructions in the most literate nation on earth. In Woodbridge's Annals of Education, a steady tattoo was directed against spelling and the alphabet method. By the time of the Gallaudet affair, both Manns were under the spell of phrenology, a now-submerged school of psychology and the brainchild of a German physician. François Joseph Gall, in working with the insane, had become convinced that he had located the physical site of personality traits like love, benevolence, acquisitiveness, and many more. He could provide a map of their positions inside the skull. These faculties signaled their presence, said Gall, by making bumps on the visible exterior of the cranium. The significance of this to the future of reading is that among Gall's claims was, too much reading causes insanity. The Manns agreed. One of Gall's converts was a Scottish lawyer named George Combe. On October 8, 1838, Mann wrote in his diary that he had met the author of that extraordinary book, The Constitution of Man, the doctrines of which will work the same change in metaphysical science that Lord Bacon wrought in natural, close quote. The book was Combe's. Suddenly, the Mann project to downgrade reading acquired a psychological leg to accompany the political, social, economic, and religious legs it already possessed. Unlike other arguments against enlightenment of ordinary people, all of which invoked one or another form of class interest, what psychological phrenology offered was a scientific argument based on the supposed best interests of the child. Thus, a potent weapon fell into pedagogy's hands, which would not be surrendered after phrenology was discredited. If one psychology could not convince, another might. By appearing to avoid any argument from special interest, the scientific case took the matter of who should learn what out of the sphere of partisan politics into a loftier realm of altruism. Meanwhile, Combe helped Mann line up his great European tour of 1843, which was to result in the shattering seventh report to the Boston School Committee of 1844. The sixth had been a plea to phrenologize classrooms. This new report said, "I am satisfied our greatest error in teaching children to read lies in beginning with the alphabet." Mann was attempting to commit Massachusetts children to the hieroglyphic system of Gallaudet. The result was an outcry from Boston schoolmasters, a battle that went on in the public press for many months, culminating on the schoolmaster's side in this familiar lament. Quote, "Education is a great concern. It has often been tampered with by vain theorists. It has suffered from the stupid folly and the delusive wisdom of its treacherous friends, and we hardly know which have injured it most. Our conviction is that it has much more hope from the collected wisdom and common prudence of the community than from the suggestions of the individual. Locke injured it by his theories, and so did Rousseau, and so did Milton. All their plans were too splendid to be true. It is to be advanced by conceptions, neither soaring above the clouds nor groveling on the earth, but by those plain, gradual, productive, common-sense improvements which use may encourage and experience suggest. We are in favor of advancement, provided it be toward usefulness. We love the secretary, but we hate his theories. They stand in the way of substantial education. It is impossible for a sound mind not to hate them." Between Mann's death and the great waves of Italian immigration after the 1870s, the country seemed content with McGuffey readers, Webster spelling books, Pilgrim's Progress, the Bible, and the familiar alphabet method for breaking the sound code. But beginning about the year 1880 with the publication of Francis W. Parker's supplementary reading for primary school, and his Talks on Pedagogics in 1883, a new attack on reading was mounted. Parker was a loud, affable, flamboyant teacher with little academic training himself. A man forced to resign as principal of a Chicago teachers' college in 1899 for reasons not completely honorable. Shortly thereafter, at the age of 62, he was suddenly selected to head the School of Education at Rockefeller's new University of Chicago, a university patterned after the great German research establishments like Heidelberg, Berlin, and Leipzig. As supervisor of schools in Boston in a former incarnation, Parker had asserted boldly that learning to read was learning a vocabulary which can be instantly recalled as ideas when certain symbolic signposts are encountered. Words are learned, he said, by repeated acts of association of the word with the idea it represents. Parker originated the famous Quincy movement, the most recognizable starting point for progressive schooling. Its reputation rested on four ideas. 1. Group activities in which the individual is submerged for the good of the collective. 2. Emphasis on the miracles of science, as opposed to traditional classical studies of history, philosophy, and literature. 3. Informal instruction in which teacher and student dress casually, call each other by first names, treat all priorities as very flexible, etc. And 4. The elimination of harsh discipline as psychologically damaging to children. Reading was not stressed in Parker's schools. Parker's work and that of other activists antagonistic to reading received a giant push forward in 1885 from one of the growing core of America's new, quote, psychologists, who had studied with Wilhelm Wundt at Leipzig. James McKean Cattell boldly announced that he had proven, using the tachistoscope, that we read whole words and not letters. Cattell's lusty ambition resounds in his cry of triumph, quote, "These results are important enough to prove those to be wrong who hold with Kant that psychology can never become an exact science," close quote. Until 1965, no one bothered to check Cattell's famous experience with the tachistoscope. When they did, it was found Cattell had been dead wrong. People read letters, not words. It was out of the cauldron of Columbia Teachers College that the most ferocious advocate of whole word therapy came. Edward Burke Huey was his name. His mentor, G. Stanley Hall. In 1908, they published an influential book, The Psychology and Pedagogy of Reading, which laid out the revolution in a way that sent a message of bonanzas to come to the new educational book publishing industry. Publishing was a business just beginning to reap fantastic profits from contracts with the new factory schools. Centralized management was providing a pot of gold for lucky book contractors in big cities. The message was this: children should be taught to read English as if it were Chinese, ideographically. Huey was even more explicit. He said, children learned to read too well and too early, and that was bad for them. Quote, "He must not, by reading adult grammatical and logical forms, begin exercises in mental habits which will violate his childhood," close quote. Huey concocted a novel justification based on Darwinian evolution, jettisoning the alphabet system. Quote, "The history of the language in which picture writing was long the main means of written communication has here a wealth of suggestions for the framers of the new primary course. It is not from mere perversity that the boy chalks or carves his records on a book and desk. There is a correspondence with, if not a direct recapitulation of the life of the race, and we owe it to the child to encourage his living through the best there is in this pictography stage." As many before him, Huey missed entirely the brilliant Greek insight that reading and understanding are two different things. Good reading is the fluent and effortless cracking of the symbol sound code, which puts understanding within easy reach. Understanding is the translation of that code into meaning. It is for many people a natural and fairly harmless mistake. Since they read for meaning, the code-cracking step is forgotten. Forgotten, that is, by those who read well. For others, self-disgust and despair, engendered by a halting process in decoding sounds, sets into play a fatal chain of circumstances which endangers the relationship to print for a long time, sometimes wrecking it forever. If decoding is a painful effort, filled with frustrating errors, finally a point is reached when the reader says, in effect, to the devil with it. Another piece of dangerous philosophy is concealed inside whole word practice. The notion that a piece of writing is only an orange one squeezes in order to extract something called meaning, some bit of data. The sheer luxury of putting your mind in contact with the greatest minds of history across time and space, feeling the rhythm of their thought, the sallies and retreats, the marshaling of evidence, the admixture of humor or beauty of observation, and many more attributes of the power and value language possesses, has something in common with being coached by Bill Walsh in football or Toscanini in orchestra conducting. How these men say what they say is as important as translating their words into your own. The music of language is what poetry and much rhetoric are about, the literal meaning often secondary. Powerful speech depends on this understanding. By 1920, the sight word method was being used in new wave progressive schools. In 1927, another professor at Columbia Teachers College, Arthur Gates, laid the foundation for his own personal fortune by writing a book called The Improvement of Reading, which purported to muster 31 experimental studies proving that sight reading was superior to phonics. All these studies are either trivial or highly ambiguous at best, and at times, in a practice widely encountered throughout higher education research in America, Gates simply draws conclusions he wants from the facts which clearly lead elsewhere. But his pièce de résistance is a comparison of first-grade deaf pupils tutored in the whole word method with Detroit first-graders. The scores of the two groups are almost identical, causing Gates to declare this a most convincing demonstration. Yet it had been well known for almost a century that deaf children taught with a method created expressly for deaf children only gain a temporary advantage which disappears quickly. In spite of this cautionary detail, Gates calls this conclusive proof that normal children taught this way would improve even faster. Shortly after the book's publication, Arthur Gates was given the task of authoring Macmillan's Basal Reader Series, a pure leap into whole word method by the most prestigious education publisher of them all. Macmillan was a corporation with wide-reaching contacts able to enhance an author's career. In 1931, Gates contributed to the growth of a new reading industry by writing an article for Parents Magazine, New Ways of Teaching Reading. Parents were told to abandon any residual loyalty they might have to the barren former older method and to embrace the new as true believers. A later article by a Gates associate was expressly tailored for those parents concerned because children do not know their letters. It explained that the modern approach to reading eliminated the boredom of code cracking. With its finger in the wind, Scott Foresman, the large educational publisher, ordered a revision of its Elson Basic Readers drawn on the traditional method, a series which had sold 50 million copies to that date. To head up the mighty project, the publisher brought in William S. Gray, Dean of the University of Chicago College of Education, to write its all-new whole-word pre-primer and primer books, a series marking the debut of two young Americans who would change millions of minds into mush during their long tenure in school classrooms. Their names were Dick and Jane. After Gates and Gray, most major publishers fell into line with other whole word series, and in the words of Rudolf Flesch, inherited the kingdom of American education with its fat royalties. Blumenfeld does the student of American schooling a great service when he compares the original 1930 Dick and Jane with its 1951 successor. Quote, In 1930, the Dick and Jane pre-primer taught 68 sign words in 39 pages of story text, with an illustration per page, a total of 565 words, and a teacher's guidebook of 87 pages. In 1951, the same book was expanded to 172 pages, with 184 illustrations, a total of 2,603 words, and a guidebook of 182 pages to teach a sight vocabulary of only 58 words. Without admitting any disorder, the publisher was protecting itself from this system, and the general public, without quite knowing why, was beginning to look at its schools with unease. By 1951, entire public school systems were bailing out on phonics and jumping onto the sight-reading bandwagon. Out of the growing number of reading derelicts poised to begin tearing the schools apart, which tormented them, a giant remedial reading industry was spawned, a new industry completely in the hands of the very universities who had with one hand written the new basal readers, and with the other taught a generation of new teachers about the wonders of the whole word method. Mute evidence that Scott Foresman wasn't just laughing all the way to the bank, but was actively trying to protect its nest egg in Dick and Jane, was its canny multiplication of words intended to be learned. In 1930, the word look was repeated 8 times. In 1951, 110 times. In the earlier version, O repeats 12 times. In the later, 138 times. In the first, C gets 27 repetitions, and in the second, 176. The legendary children's book author Dr. Seuss, creator of a string of bestsellers using a controlled, quote, scientific vocabulary supplied by the publisher, demonstrated his own awareness of the mindlessness of all of this in an interview he gave in 1981. I did it for a textbook house, and they sent me a word list. That was due to the Dewey Revolt in the 20s, in which they threw out phonics reading and went to a word recognition system, as if you're reading a Chinese pictograph instead of blending sounds or different letters. I think killing phonics was one of the greatest causes of illiteracy in the country. Anyway, they had it all worked out that a healthy child at the age of 4 can only learn so many words in a week. So there were 223 words to use in this book. I read the list 3 times and I almost went out of my head. I said, I'll read it once more, and if I can find 2 words that rhyme, that'll be the title of my book. I found cat and hat and said, the title of my book will be The Cat in the Hat. Close quote. For the 41 months beginning in January of 1929 and concluding in June of 1932, there were 88 articles written in various pedagogical journals on the subject of reading difficulties and remedial teaching. In the 41 months beginning in July of 1935 and concluding in December of 1938, the number rose almost 200% to 239. The first effects of the total victory of the whole word reading philosophy were being reflected in academic journals as the once mighty reading Samson of America was led eyeless to Gaza with the rest of the slaves.